driving Dillingham to my car. I drive around it because work isn't very far. I call my phone and I check my messages, but I don't have any messages. All I know, driving on drugs feels better when they're prescription. All I know, the world looks beautiful, the world looks so damn beautiful. I feel fantastic, and I never felt as good.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Tomefoolery. I am Runjit Sowry.
And I'm Cody Melcher. How's it going, Runjit?
It's great. How are you this evening, Cody?
I'm doing all right. I'm just hanging in there.
Good.
Yeah, you know, doing the best I can.
That's awesome.
I feel like I'm doing better than the people in this story.
Yeah, so the people something. In the story not doing too well.
Not too well at all.
A lot of degeneration happening.
Yeah. You know, we should have been aware of this was going to happen. Like that, especially coming in on a Lovecraft story. You just have to know.
He loved degeneration. He was obsessed with it.
Oh yeah. And we'll talk more about that. And just for the top, so that the people who aren't reading the title of the episode will know, we are talking, of course, about The Shadow over Innsmouth by Mr. H.P. Lovecraft. What does the H.P. stand for again? Do you remember? I don't.
Something Phillips.
Howard?
What is it?
Is it Howard,
Howard Phillips?
Harold Phillips? We'll find out. I'm sure our guest knows, considering that he's nodding emphatically.
Yes, he does know. He's not allowed to talk quite yet, but he's going to right now, because here he is, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Dan Telfer.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, Dan.
Hey there, Dan. How are you today?
Oh, I'm quite well.
Good. So what does the HP stand for?
Howard Phillips.
Howard Phillip. Okay. All right. Dan, how's it going?
It's going great.
Having a good night?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, Dan, what we like to do is we like to ask you the question that I'm about to ask you. It's a good setup for this one. What do you normally read? Like, what are you into? What's your digs?
I love fiction. Mm-hmm. Nonfiction was something I was incredibly fascinated with in my 20s, and now I just feel like there's a lot more I can learn. But like usually not books, like books I use primarily like escapism. For more of my nonfiction, I prefer like a nice documentary.
Okay, cool. Specifically, do you have any documentaries or even nonfiction books specifics? Anything you've seen lately or in your 20s that really got you?
I really liked Things Fall Apart by, I think, how is it pronounced? Like Chinua?
Some weird African name.
That's a really good one. Upside Down World.
Don't know that one.
I don't know that one. What's Upside Down World about?
It's about the lie that Western civilization in the Northern Hemisphere is the dominant culture.
I took a class like that in college.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with this documentary that's not that socially progressive. I think it's called Urban Explorers. It's
on Netflix. Oh, I heard about that one. Yeah.
Where like they go in like abandoned hospitals and underground sewer drains and stuff like that.
Nice.
And just, oh my god! And it was filmed in the early aughts, and then like immediately the entire community was like dismantled because like. It had already been getting investigated. They did all their socializing on like message boards online and like
weird.
Yeah, people were getting sick, and I think a couple people died because of just all the fumes.
Oh, wow.
Like you can fall off of buildings that are condemned and
yeah.
Was this like Detroit or something?
Everywhere.
Oh, everywhere.
Yeah, like it was an online community of like who can find a cool place to explore in the middle of the night.
Yeah, kind of like, I guess it's kind of like Ghost Hunters without the ghost part.
Yeah, and that's what, you know what, you hit the nail on the head. That's what I love about it, because I always want to like shows like Ghost Hunters, but I get incredibly irritated by the pompous sort of like, we know something non-believers don't attitude. Like, I have no problem with believing in ghosts. I have a problem with telling other people they have to believe in ghosts.
Yeah.
And that's what those shows are about, like proving, like sticking it to people. But Urban Explorers lets you completely decide, and that for me is like I'd never seen anything like that before.
In terms of fiction, what's your digs? Obviously Lovecraft.
Yeah, and I just like science. I like really good science fiction. I like really pulpy stuff. Okay. I also was like so obsessed with Chuck Palahniuk.
Oh, okay, in my 20s.
Like that guy.
What's your favorite of his books?
Lullaby.
Nice.
Is so good.
Good choice. Yeah.
I and that when he was like I got to meet him and
wow.
And he was just like a, you know,
at a book signing?
Yeah. Actually at a book signing where I was the only one who showed up. This was back in
was this pre Fight Club?
2000. No, it was like a year after Fight Club. Like there should have been so many people there, but it was poorly publicized. And yeah, he signed my book and I was just like,
so you probably just got to hang out with him for a while.
Yeah, for about 90 minutes.
We just talked,
man. We just talked about like what it's like to write a novel. Because I, at that point, I had written a couple of like, you know, 30 page short stories and was just like, it was like 22 or something like that. I was just like, yeah, really excited to meet him. And
well, let's talk about H.P. Lovecraft's book.
Okay.
What do you guys think?
Well, it's a, first of all, it's a novella.
Yeah, and you know what I would like to jump in and say, like,
yeah,
I suggested this book.
Yes, you did.
You said for the Halloween episode you'd love to do H.P. Lovecraft with me because you knew I liked him.
Right.
So I want to hear, and this might be totally against your format, what you both thought in like one sentence about this story in like the most honest way possible. Because just from a social, like we're all friends kind of thing, I made you read this.
Yes, you did.
So
this podcast always involves two people being forced to read a book
by a third person. You were clearly game with the author, but because this author has a lot of infamous qualities to him, I'm very curious just what your immediate, honest, summarized impression.
Well, my impression is I loved it, and it actually spurred me, reading this book spurred me to do more research into like the life of H.P. Lovecraft and kind of a lot of other things about it. Because I've been a Lovecraft fan for years, but I hadn't read like all his stuff and hadn't read this one. So this was a great experience for me to read this story.
You'd read Call of Cthulhu?
Yes, I'd read that and the Mountains of Madness and a few short stories that I can't name, like, you know, a few years ago or many years ago. What about you, Cody?
Kind of the same. I actually had not read this one, even though I've read a lot of his stuff and I've also just read like a lot of snippets of his stuff, you know, here and there, because I kind of, you know, I'm in that comic book circle nerd world, so you know, I get a lot of extraneous Lovecraft without ever like actually seeking out a lot of it that often. But I read it a lot when I was younger. Yeah, it reminded me a lot of Mountains of Madness, actually, like even the structure.
Really?
Yeah, a little bit. Like I feel like a lot of Lovecraft novels or novellas start off with this kind of like introduction of this character who's like, this thing happened to me and let me tell you about it, but you're not going to believe me.
Well,
and it's I feel like every Lovecraft collection should just have the first chapter be an introduction to like a generalized introduction to a character who's telling you a story, and then everything else just cuts off that intro.
Well, that's the trick though. Like you say, it reminds you of Mountains of Madness. All that really says to me after you say your reasons is you need to read more Lovecraft.
Right. Well,
because you do and you don't, because you do because it will provide some lovely perspective, but you don't in that what you will discover is that is true in every like. In dozens of stories.
Yeah.
Like it is not unique to these two you have just compared to each other. Like, he has so many cliches and tropes.
Right.
That, like, no matter how much you like him, you have to admit, like, boy, there's a formula here. and I know exactly where this is going.
And the narrator is always a white guy who's highly educated.
Yeah.
I'm very glad you guys both like this, because this, you know, I just asked a gentleman who is not white and a gentleman who is not straight to read a book that is by an incredibly close-minded rich white dude who shivered in his aunt's bosom until he died of paranoia. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of clear indications that he was a close-minded person.
Oh, yeah. yeah, I mean, like, and again, we're both familiar with Lovecraft, so I think we kind of knew that coming into it. And I mean, that also kind of just fits the ethos of the podcast. That's what we've been tackling for the last few months, is that kind of mentality.
Because you had Sherman on, right? And didn't you do a book with racism in it?
Yeah, we did Edgar Allan Poe's only novel, The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket, which has hugely racist things going on in there.
Right. That's so. The bummer of, like, that era is there's some really good, like, Anglo fiction, like, horror especially, honestly.
Yeah,
I'm like,
yeah.
And it's really close-minded. It's really frustrating to read, especially if you know the good parts will appeal to you directly, because then the bad parts can be so alienating that you feel like you need to apologize for it when you force your friends to read it.
Right.
Right. But with Lovecraft, to bring it back into Lovecraft, I mean, yeah, I'm used to, because you were talking about, like, kind of being apologetic when you talk to other people about it, and you have to kind of take that with a grain of sand, because the problem is also that it's hard. There are a lot of artists that have negative personalities, and you can remove the art from the personality, but Lovecraft is hard because he includes a lot of it in his art. You can't really read a lot of Lovecraft and just go, well, the person may not have, you know, been like this, but, like, you can look past it.
Yeah, and how it works for me with him, because he's like the exception for me. There's a lot of authors or artists who are abhorrent in their personal lives. Mm-hmm. Who I have friends who are like, don't be such a tight ass, Dan. This is enjoyable stuff. I cannot touch anything remotely related to Orson Scott Card.
I was just about to say that.
I think he is a tool. And the idea that he's written good science fiction is ridiculous to me, because it's like, it's still science fiction with really creepy, like undertones of, like, father figure molestation. And you're like, what? Like, you have unresolved issues. And if the way it's affecting your art is very arrogant.
Yeah.
And what I like about H.P. Lovecraft is, like, even if he tries to have a certain haughtiness, all of his characters die, become, like, shivering cannibals, or art, like, it's every story is like a perfectly transparent window into his sad, terrifying, like, whimpery little baby soul.
Oh,
and, like,
yeah.
For that reason, I feel like he can say almost anything in a story, and I still end up going, like, well, he's admitting he's an incredibly flawed person just by putting this out in the world. And when this got released, he was trying to get these published in these pulp magazines that were not respected, and he was getting rejected. And it like, some of his best stories were rejected, like, outright by everyone.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like, he was crippled emotionally, and it comes across, and that is appealing to me. Like he's such a flawed figure. Even if he was rich, he still lived with, didn't he live with his aunt?
Well, and then he died poor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Poe before him.
Yeah, that's right.
I was also thinking about Poe.
That's right. And I think his dad, like, went crazy when he was, like, 3 or something, and then was in a psychiatric hospital for the rest of his life. And so, yeah, Lovecraft was just obsessed with, you know, the degeneration of the human body and of the human mind.
Yeah, well, and right, didn't he live with his elderly aunt and, like,
yes,
and, like, some other old woman,
yeah,
like, whole adult life, like, yeah. And I want to say, like, she became an, like, invalid, and he had to, like, sponge bathe her, and, like,
yeah,
it's like the guy lived a sad life.
Yeah, but just to be clear, though, he did get married at some point and then lived with his wife for a while, but then they got divorced. Oh, which brings me to a game I wanted to play with you guys, actually.
Oh, okay.
Okay, the game. It's called Guess What Type of Business Establishment H.P. Lovecraft's Wife Owned.
Oh,
that's the name of the game. Guess,
you know
what type of business establishment.
Okay.
I used to know this.
An opium den?
No. I'll give you, like, 2 or 3 guesses before I give you a clue.
Good, good. I like lots of guesses.
Okay.
I do not like easy clues. A pharmaceutical, like, executive kind of position.
No.
Haberdashery.
A hat store.
Yeah!
Yes! A hat store Cody, ladies and gentlemen, loves hats.
I also work at
a hat works at a hat store.
Yeah.
You share an obsession with H.P. Lovecraft's wife.
Fantastic.
Isn't that weird?
It is weird, and I look forward to talking with her ghost at some point about hats.
Yeah, and in fact, there people think that there may be a connection here between his like racism and this little story here, which is that so he was born and like grew up in Providence, Rhode Island.
He lived in Providence.
Yeah, Providence, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. And then when he married his wife, she was from Brooklyn, so he moved to Brooklyn to be with her. Mm. But then she lost her hat store, and she had to move to Cleveland to find work. Okay, so then he was alone in Brooklyn trying to find work, and this was right about the time when a lot of immigrants were coming into New York City.
Yeah,
and so he couldn't find work, and he would see all these immigrants working, and there's speculation that this like fueled his kind of already. Yeah,
I've read a lot about his xenophobia and like he hated living in New York.
Yes.
I mean, he kind of sounds like the birth of the modern day Tea Party. That kind of imagery of like they're taking all of our jobs and we have to do something about it.
And I told you guys before, and this was one of my top three favorite.
Right.
Like tied.
What were the other two?
Can I say now? Because you wouldn't let me say before.
Well, because we wanted to save it for the podcast.
Mountains of Madness.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Obviously. And the Dunwich Horror.
I've not read the Dunwich Horror.
It's fucking awesome. And what I like about those three is that there's something about them that he does best in each of them. But like the reason I suggested this one is I feel like this is the most unique in a lot of ways and also indicative. Like I feel like the whole de-evolution thing is an obvious recurring theme in his work. However, the fish like merman thing was awesome to me. Like, I feel like this was the closest he came to overcoming the sort of like wimpy racism he's known for and making it like he still fucks it up and makes himself look like a dumbass. Right. Like, where he says, like, you know, the esoteric order of the Dagon came from the East in this kind of like racist way about,
it's a Philistine god.
Yeah. Like,
And
it's like, give me a break. But he does try to ascribe it to an earlier race that then came into Innsmouth that was like not a human race. It was a demon, like otherworldly, like fish people who had nothing to do with just like subhumans. They were literally like another. They were people becoming creatures to serve, you know, an alien god. It wasn't
alien as in extraterrestrial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so many of his stories, like Call of Cthulhu, man, there is some racist shit in there.
Oh yeah.
Where like he just talks about all the mulattoes and the bayou and like it's you're like, blech, like shut up.
Cthulhu, that's how you say it?
Yeah.
That's how I say it.
I've been told you can say Cthulhu or Cthulhu, but I prefer Cthulhu because Cthulhu sounds too hard.
I think I looked this up, and you know how whenever you look up someone like Gaddafi,
yeah,
you'll see like 18,000 different spellings. I think Cthulhu was like that, or maybe it was pronunciations.
It's got a lot.
There's a bunch of pronunciations.
It's got a lot of pronunciations. I don't like Cthulhu because it sounds like the elder god of like the Dr. Seuss universe.
Right. And
Cthulhu.
I also it's got that air of like trying too hard, which I feel like with any niche like author or artist, like it's if there's a raving fan base, nice to distance yourself a little bit from the people who strangle you with pedantics, like or semantics.
I have a question, Dan, because now we've got a Lovecraft expert in the audience. I mean, in the room. I was playing the board game, one of the board games in the Lovecraft universe with some friends, and we were looking at all. You're basically battling different types of elder gods as like the villains. We could not figure out why Cthulhu is the most well known of the Lovecraft universe because I don't think he's even the most powerful, really.
As far as I can tell. He's just one of a couple major god types who are really large and show up.
Okay.
Like, so many of the stories, you hear about them, or you, like, some ancient texts, and then the guy just ends up going bananas and, like, biting his friend's arm off.
Mm-hmm.
Cthulhu is, like, a general in the weird-ass space army who lives in a sunken city.
The theory that we had was that he was also maybe one of the easier ones to draw. Because if we're talking about fan bases, because you were saying, a lot of them are just kind of this weird other thing. Especially some of them have really complicated descriptions. Like, the visuals are just like a bunch of eyes.
The Dunwich Horror is a really good example of where he invents two different monsters that are really difficult to imagine. Like, the other one in Dunwich Horror, Wilbur Whately, like, you don't really see how deformed he is till he dies. And then he's just sort of a corpse. Like, you see his clothes, like, unfurl, and he's got these weird deformed demon parts. And you're like, and even the author, narrator voice is like, I couldn't tell, like, what certain parts were as a result of his injuries or, or part of the writhing mess that was his original form. And it's like, what the fuck is even happening? He's half goat with, like, a worm thigh. Like,
well, Lovecraft, he actually really liked that idea of like, fear of the unknown. Like, what you don't know is scarier than what you know. So there's actually a lot of that. I know that's not exactly what you're talking about, but it kind of reminded me of that.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it's kind of like if a Hitchcock wasn't in a visual medium. So it doesn't, I don't know if it plays as well.
Yeah, and like, he builds tension, like, and in a good way. And I just get frustrated with the dude because he's kind of also like sometimes the Tom Clancy of horror. Where, like, he tries to build, like, fear by describing, like, the tiles on the floor. And you're like, I get it, buddy. And, like his route to the grocery store is, like, and then as I, you know, checked my watch, I realized I'd paced myself 30 yards ahead of schedule. You're like, we get this is going somewhere scary, buddy.
Like, yeah, the introduction to Innsmouth is really, like, the whole first, like, part of the of this novella is almost entirely just
walking around.
Yeah, and, like, I'm going to set up. The first, like, two pages of the one that I was reading was literally just him talking about how horrible of a story he's about to tell
But I love that it has, like, an urban explorer, like, abandoned Detroit, like, kind of feel to it where, like, this old city has got nobody left. Like, he doesn't see anybody.
Here's the thing I don't understand about the city. So, and it bugged me, and this is a problem that I have sometimes where I just start thinking too much about things before I get into it. In the beginning, they're describing Innsmouth. And it's this port town that was really big up until the War of 1812. But it is almost entirely, like, it keeps outsiders out because there are the marshes around it. But yet there's obvious roads that come in and out of it, and a train, because of the bus. The bus goes through it, so obviously there are roads into it. And then also, how can you be a major port town if you're secluded from the rest of the country if there are a bunch of marshes?
Well, I think Federal Street is the only street that goes in and out of town.
Right.
I could be wrong. Like, I think everything else ends at the marsh.
Yeah.
And...
but that still is not going to keep people out, because that's a road.
Yeah, but, like, I also think that bus is, like, they go pretty far the way to describe it as rickety and unfriendly, and nobody gets off at that stop, and people's brains almost erase it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a world before, like, common maps, and, like...
Right,
the idea that you would even want to get off at a stop that was unsavory was insane. And he's playing off that. You know?
Right. And, well, and I guess not everybody had cars as easy where you just go drive through.
Cars.
Right.
I mean, this was
right.
The beauty of this is it was right when Ford sort of like got these things cheap.
Yeah.
Like, and so much of the cars in it and the vehicles are like the first.
Right.
So people were scared of getting in a, like, and even a train. Those had only been around for, like, 30 years.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, the idea of going to a weird place really quickly and seeing, like, unusual scenery was, like, unheard of.
Yeah.
And part of what he's trying to build up, like, this was still in an era where you could get lost in America really easily. You know, you can't do that at all anymore.
Yeah.
There's a radio tower, a cell phone tower, like, almost everywhere. I mean, granted, you know, if you have T-Mobile, you can get lost really easily.
Yeah, and I guess, like, in the West, you can still kind of get lost out in the deserts, or in Texas, I definitely have driven around in areas where you lose cell phone reception. You know where
you're different. Going. I mean, yeah. Just think of the fact that you can own a GPS that will work anywhere as long as you're not too indoors.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
Like the satellites will take care of
it. Yeah, you can be in the middle of nowhere, but in the middle of like a desert and be lost. But the idea that you can be lost with a town there. Like that kind of old staple of horror movie where you roll into a place and there's like a rickety gas station with a guy with a rifle and
right, that's gone completely.
Yeah, you can't. And that was
one of the biggest complaints I had with Cabin in the Woods.
I was just thinking about Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah, like the idea that like, oh, it's not even on, there's not even a road on this map. Like I feel like then when they finally, spoiler, I'm gonna just spoil everything.
spoiler alert.
I have not.
I
do
have
care
it.
If I spoil it?
No, spoil it.
I have. Okay. I love it.
It was okay. I mean, like, I felt like when they revealed the entire world government was funding this experiment, I went, yeah, no shit. That's the only way you can keep a street off a fucking map now. Like, I was like, yeah, that's the deus ex machina you need. Like, yeah, the reason, like, all this stuff is possible is because the universe funded it. And what I like about this kind of, like, thing is, like, being able to picture being alive at that time. And, like, I just like being able to imagine being in, like, the 20s and, like, like, taking a bus.
And then like the bus weird, breaking down yeah. after it drops you off.
That's yeah. part of it. It's not at all as soon as I hear that happen, going like, oh man, but the 20s, you know, like yeah. I really like to immerse myself in yeah. what that means. And that's part of the real, like getting in a time, like imagine that happens. There's demons mm-hmm. and now there's marshes in every direction.
Yeah,
I feel like you're so fucked, and that's kind of fucked you can't be anymore.
Yeah, you can't just get on a cell phone and call somebody.
Okay, so what did you guys like about it then? Because I feel like we there's so much to talk about why like his the man's flaws, but you said you liked the story that I tricked you into reading.
Well, I here's something I'm going to admit. I'm sure this makes me way less intelligent than both of you. I didn't see the ending coming. That makes me dumb, right?
No.
No, it just means you haven't read a lot of H.P. Lovecraft.
Okay, okay.
And when I say a lot, I don't mean it in a haughty way. I mean it
No. I've only read a few of his
stuff. If you read three H.P. Lovecraft stories, you've read two where the main character descends into madness at the end.
Funny.
I think Call of Cthulhu and Mountains of Madness might actually be like the only two I can think of where the main character is like semi-coherent. And you know, like so many of them, it's like, and that's part of what is really frustrating. It's like they fall into madness, and then you're like, well, then how did you just tell me a 60-page story?
We had that problem with Arthur Gordon Pym.
Exactly, I was actually going to bring that up because we're talking about it. Yeah, that was the same problem we had in Pym, because with that he disappears at the end of the novel. This white lady shows up, and then they just suddenly like the book it just ends, and so it's like, well. How, but it's all in past tense. So it's how did you tell us? There's this theory that he's dead and retelling it. It's the same kind of thing.
I'm okay here with that to a certain extent, but the thing that Lovecraft does that drives me bonkers is the literal narrative voice descends into Cthulhu speak all the time with all that consonant apostrophe nonsense.
Yeah.
And you're left going like in this one in particular. He's like a fish man without a larynx the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
He's telling it from the point of view of somebody who's basically a fish man without a larynx. And you're like, so did you write it? No, you got fins. You're a mud person. You spoil these stories, right? Like, okay.
Oh, yeah, spoilers. Yeah, you're fine. Yeah.
All right, so we talked about what we were going to like, and then immediately started talking about what we didn't like again. So you, but you liked, yeah. You didn't see the end coming.
One thing I didn't, and well, I actually ended up reading it like 3 times, like in the last month. And then each time I read it, I got more of it. Like the first, there were a lot of things I didn't actually get on the first read that I only got later.
Like what?
Let's see. The so-called epidemic of like 1846, you know, I didn't get on the first read that what actually happened was that the fish people, you know, the what's his name? Marsh, Obed Marsh.
Yeah.
And his people got thrown into jail. Like the good people of the town took over and they were like, no, we're not going to worship the devil. You know, we're going to arrest all these people. And so there were no sacrifices made to the fish people, right, for like months, and the fish people and the Shoggoths came up out of the sea and just kicked everybody's ass and like killed everyone. That's what the great epidemic of 1846 was. I didn't catch that on the first read, and that's kind of a major plot point, actually.
Yeah, but he does leave a lot of that to your imagination. You're supposed to remember like the entire exposition when you get to reveals, and you're supposed to piece that together retroactively, and it's so dense sometimes.
Yeah, and then some of the stuff is just hard to understand because it's written in dialect. Like, you know, there's long...
Yeah, that old dude's monologue where he's like just
long
wigging out.
Long monologue, pages and pages of this guy, Zadok Allen, talking with in total dialect, which actually...
Drunk.
Yeah, he's drunk and he's 90. Right,
and drunk,
he's
90-year-old,
and he's 90
with a hillbilly accent.
That's right, and I actually have a little game for you guys.
Okay,
I call it the Zadok Allen Spelling Bee.
This is already my favorite game I've ever played in my entire
so,
life.
Okay, so Dan, you have to spell the first word. Now I will be saying these as they are correctly pronounced. So the way I say it might not be the way it was spelled in the book.
Okay,
all right. So, Dan, your word is half.
I'm going to say H-A-L-V-T.
Wrong. Cody, do you want to take a quick guess?
Half. Half?
Yes.
Half. H A F F.
That is right.
Oh!
H-A-F-F.
Oh, man.
Yeah, because see, the logic, guys, is that the man who speaks in this dialect does not pronounce the L, as opposed
half?
To the rest of us who say half.
Half.
Right? So, but he doesn't pronounce the L. Do you understand?
Yeah.
So it's H-A-F-F. Okay, Dakota, you get the first crack at this next one.
All right.
Venture.
Could you use it in a sentence?
That was an exciting venture that we went on.
All right, thank you.
I ended with a preposition just for you.
I appreciated it. V-I-N-S-H-U-R.
No. Dan, you want to take a stab at venture?
Yeah. V-E-N apostrophe C-H-E-R.
Good tactic with the apostrophe, but no. It's V-E-N-T-E-R.
Vinter?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Just a couple of more here. Okay, this one.
This is the best thing you can do after reading this novel is play this game.
This was so hard to read. This was for like pages and pages.
Oh, I know.
Of this guy talking.
Oh, man.
Monologizing.
Have you ever read Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban?
No,
he's another one of my favorite authors. He wrote Bread and Jam for Francis, Bedtime for Francis, the little badger girl.
I don't know.
It was like kids' books, but then he also wrote these amazing adult novels.
And he writes a lot of dialect.
He wrote one book called Ridley Walker that's a post-apocalyptic story that takes place in England where language has completely degenerated.
Mm.
And like it's hundreds of years after a nuclear apocalypse. And it's all in dialect like that. Impenetrable. There's a glossary, plus he wants you to just figure a lot out by yourself.
Clockwork Orange was like that.
Anthony Burgess. It is like reading aloud Clockwork Orange with like a mouthful of like like cotton candy, like melting and like absorbing all the, yeah.
Here's your word, Dan. Daughters, meaning, you know, that man has many daughters.
His progeny.
And no sons.
Do you think you're tipping your hand a little bit by the way you very deliberately pronounced it just then?
No, I was just trying to pronounce it.
I'm trying to cheat. D-A-H-W-T-E-R-S.
Oh, that's great. No.
I'm putting a lot of H's in there, I just realized.
Cody, you want to give it a stab?
Daughters. D-A-W-T-U-R-S. Daughters.
These are great. It's D-A-R-T-E-R-S.
Daughters?
Yes.
That's it. And I'm not getting the dialect right, because if I were if I were going Southern hillbilly, I would definitely be getting this a lot better.
Yeah, the DAW, that's
way
very
more southern than it should be.
I know it is. That, there was actually an audio book that I was looking at
that was very southern, right? Was it the Atlanta?
Yeah, the
theater
company. Yeah, whatever? Yeah. And then there was one where there was a British narrator, and they said that it was too southern.
Yes.
The dialects. Yeah.
A lot of South in here. Two more, just because these two I love.
All right.
Okay.
By the way, this is really fun to play, so if this isn't fun to listen to, go fuck yourself.
All right. This next one is actually a phrase.
Oh.
Ought to. Like, I ought to go work out, which I ought to, actually. I ought to go work out.
Is this mine?
Ought to. This is you, Cody.
A-W-T-U.
No.
I think I might got this one.
Okay, ready? I'm ready.
A-W-T-I-R.
you guys are both so far off. That's not funny. But one thing you did do correctly is you made it into one word, which he does.
Yes, okay.
So you got that right. It's O-R-T-E-R.
O-R-T-E-R.
I think I was pretty close. I was like three letters A-W? Off. I smashed it together.
There's an order. That's order with a T. That's, man.
Okay, one last one.
All right.
Okay. Last one. I think, Dan, you're first.
Okay.
I'm not even, I'll say the note after. Jail.
Oh, no.
Jail.
All right. I'd like to use my lifeline on this. Cody's cat. Can you? Jail. Because I'm really trying to literally visually recall the way the words looked on the page, and it's not helping me. Let's just say J-A-L.
Wrong. Ooh. Cody, you want to give it a shot?
J-A-Y-E-R.
J-A-Y-E-R.
Jayer.
No.
Oh, that's actually good.
I thought going
you were not bad.
Yeah.
Do you want to give it another shot?
Yeah.
Okay, one more shot for each of you for jail.
Jail.
Actually, let's let Cody go first on this one.
Yeah.
So you go again, Cody.
J-O-R-E-L.
No.
Okay.
Like an Arab man's name.
It's Jor-El, father of Kal-El.
J-A-apostrophe-E-R.
Oh,
no.
I like it.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you this one.
All right.
This one is so far off that I am not even sure that's actually jail. Okay? But it's G-A-O-L.
Gaul?
G-A-O-L.
Oh, no!
But...
that's actually just an old form of spelling jail.
Oh, is it? Well, you know, I actually, the only way I figured out that was jail was from context, because it was the part about when the people of the town in 1846 and the epidemic, how the good people took over and they threw all the devil worshippers into jail, and it was G-A-O-L. And yeah, I had no idea. I'd never seen that word before.
Oh, yeah.
No?
Nope. I used to pronounce it Gaul.
You have?
Huh?
You have, Dan?
No.
Oh. One thing I enjoyed about this book as well was there were a few moments of unintentional humor. that really kind of tickled me.
All of his books.
Yeah, that's definitely Lovecraft.
Well, here was one, okay? The clerk at the YMCA where he was staying, he was staying the night at the first city he was in. What was it called? Anybody remember? Sudburyport or something like that.
Newburyport.
Newburyport. Yeah. So he was staying at the Y, and the clerk there tells him, "Oh, Innsmouth, don't stay at the Gilman House because it's crappy," basically.
Yeah.
This is somebody at the Y telling you not to stay at a particular hotel.
Maybe back then the Y was a little more respectable. Yeah. My favorite unintentional humor in this is the impenetrably stupid names for things that are all fish puns. The Gilman? Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
Marsh? What? Like...
Yeah, the minute I read Marsh, I knew where we were going. I was like, yeah, oh, like,
the hotel janitor's name is Waterfella. Like, it's really, not really, but like, it's, there's a lot of that in this one.
Somebody's initial is C, and then her last name is Creature.
I think you're making that one
up.
Oh,
I know. But I would expect
the way
it.
They unveil the jewelry in Newburyport's really fun. Like, and I think there's like a lot of when he learns about the reef is really cool. And I feel like what he's really good at is backstory. And what he's also good at is building tension. And it's like, I wish more people understood that. Like, I feel like a lot of other people I talk to about Lovecraft, they love the intentional humor, like, almost exclusively, or they love the, like, just piles of, like, they want too much science fiction. Like,
yeah.
Like one thing that drives me crazy about the what is it called? The, like, the Lovecraft fan fiction. There's, like, a specific word for it. Yeah, it's like the Cthulhu mythos.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Like, people invented way too many elder gods. Like there's like,
yeah.
Yeah.
There's like a radish with like a bleeding eyeball in it that represents like the center of the galaxy, and you're like, what
the fuck? His fans are just, you know, like you said, they're crazy.
Yeah. They're cool because they have amazing imagination.
And God bless
them
for keeping him alive, you know.
Well, yeah, but like then you know that's the thing. Like you'll want a Miskatonic University hoodie. But to wear it means you invite people to ask you if you know about the radish with a bleeding eyeball. Yeah. And it's like, oh, sorry, I didn't read his grandnephew's friends, you know. I have a Twitter account called Lovecraft Cat.
I did not know this. Cody, did you?
I didn't know this either.
I'm trying to look it up.
Dan
Telfer,
Man of Mysteries.
Okay, while you're doing that... here's one more moment of unintentional humor. Okay, so this is at the very end of the book. As may well be imagined, I gave up most of the four planned features of the rest of my tour. Gee, do you think? you like 300 fish frog humanoids just crawled out of the sea and tried to murder you. So you think you might... Cut that vacation short.
I feel like it's another era thing too. Like I feel like part of it is like back then people would do something like that if they saw something horrible. Like they would just barely grab onto their wits, and then their first instinct would be like, "I think I should make some tea." Like, would either of you like to see my Lovecraft's Cat tweets?
Of course.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Lovecraft's
Cat? We'd like to
Cat?
hear them.
Do you know this bit of trivia?
Are you talking about the N-word cat?
Yeah, do you know about the N-word
cat?
I
do not.
Sherman briefly mentioned it on the first episode.
Oh, I missed it.
H.P. Lovecraft grew up with a cat named N-word Man. Makes no sense. I've thought about this, and I cannot for life me figure out any reason to name your cat N-word Man.
Wow.
Actually, I have a friend whose dad named their cat the N-word.
Think those people are disturbing.
Oh, yeah.
But he grew up, like, his parents named it that, and he loved this cat. And I feel like that is a huge window into his racism, where, like, he loved the soul of this thing, and affectionately, every morning, be like, come here, N-word man. Like, come here. And in his book, Rats in the Walls, the main character inherits this castle. Mm-hmm. And he brings this cat, who is also named N-word man.
He writes it
into the story. And it's hilarious because it's a silly name for a person or an animal. It makes no sense just like phonetically. And so if you had named a cat Spike, and you see the word Spike coming like halfway through the sentence, you go like, oh, here comes a cat. You know what I mean?
Right.
You start a sentence, you see Spike in the corner of your vision, you go, it's a cat sentence.
Yeah. Right.
But in this, all of a sudden you see the N-word coming, and you can, there's nothing a modern mind can do to prepare itself for the N-word coming and being about a cat. Like every time you see it coming halfway down the sentence, you're like, what's about the fuck? And like, and then
especially because it's Lovecraft.
Like a fraction of a second.
Yeah. Like there's 10 times in Rats in the Walls where you think the story is going to take a hard left into just like berating black people into sadness. And like, it just ends up being about like a fleck of dust. So I think that like that was funny to me. Not the racism. That's terrible. But like, the idea that, like, reading the story, like, this cat is, and the cat is so innocent. It's just this silly old cat who can tell where the rats are. And so I've made this Twitter account, Lovecraft Cat.
Yeah, let's hear some of these tweets. All right. Do you have them?
I do. Abhorrence. 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 Bit of soot blowing around. Abhorrence. Abhorrence. Fish bits. Abhorrence. When the miasma creeps beneath your door, assail it with your claw, run amok, knock over a paperweight, take a nap on the Necronomicon.
Ah, yes.
Ack!
I gotta subscribe to this.
Ack! Excuse me. No, normal cat business. Nothing conceptual. Ack! Its face was more shifting, sinewy nightmare than form. A gaze pierced me to the quick, and I knew the unspeakable. I peed upon its jacket.
Oh, these are great.
The shambling terror lurched. The creaks of its joints echoed ancient civilizations, still decomposing and suffering. All dogs are like this. I had no laser pointer in the 1880s. I had to chase the glowing red eyes of the non-corporeal Delapore rat army. They were easier to catch. The cosmos looks upon man with indifference, and it may blink through the entirety of civilization. Also, naps. And there's about 90 more of those.
Is there a tweet where the cat just starts devolving into Cthulhu like speech?
No, although I did recently try a political one, and I think it got one fave. No, two retweets and two favorites.
Ooh.
I see the Dunwick Horror is running for Senate in Missouri. He changed his name from Waitley to Aiken. Odd that he did not change his face.
Oh.
So the ending.
Yes. The one that the ultimate ending.
The ultimate ending.
Right. Cause I feel like it takes turns towards the end where it starts almost ending and then doesn't end and then almost ends and doesn't end. That might just
because he escapes and some time goes by before he really reveals he went back. And...
Right.
Well, he goes back to his senior year at Oberlin, which felt kind of out of place to me in that story.
I'm surprised he didn't go to Miskatonic.
It's like, yo, man, I'm a senior at Oberlin.
So here's what I always want to ask other Lovecraft nerds. What do you think happens next? Because I feel like the big dumb thing when the characters go mad is like,
yeah,
rubber room. But like, what do you think really happens? What do you think happens
after the end of the book?
Mm-hmm.
You're asking. Yeah. We're thinking. That's a good question. What happens after the end of the book?
Because I feel like the easy answer is the apocalypse comes and he's like a foot soldier and then everything is laid waste. But what I like to think is like these guys. You think about the War of 1812, and then like 100 years later, they finally have like another uprising.
Yeah.
Like 2012. Like I like to think that like they have another go. But here's the thing. They have another go, and then it becomes a small fishing town, and then like the 80s happen, and like the government just quietly, like, quietly puts down the whole town completely, like just raises it. And then the Devil Serif, like, fish people come up. And there's a lot. There's, like, an infinite number of them. But there's no human people, like, there to, like, help summon them. And they're kind of, like, confused and, like, where did all the jewelry go? Like, what?
And like, I think they can't actually be on land for too long, right? That's my impression.
That's the impression I got, too. Like, yeah. Like, they come out and they need their half-evolved, like, priests and stuff.
Right, exactly.
So, like, I feel like there's enough of them where they could fuck some people up. But I also like the idea of, like, so many of these Lovecraft stories have, like, an almost reversed cabin in the wood. And cabin in the woods. I mean, we're like... Like, the unknowable horror comes from the center of the planet, and the armies are actually like, that's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. Like, we can handle this. Like, we've actually invested all of our resources into weapons, so it's not a big deal.
Well, and here's the other thing. When in this book, what's it called again? The Shadow Over. It slipped my mind for a sec. When the government came in,
madness.
Yeah.
When the government came in and they actually shot torpedoes into the undersea little village that the deep ones were living in. Why didn't they blow up Devil's Reef?
They didn't know. I don't think
they didn't know. About Devil's Reef?
Devil's Reef is, or like, so far out they didn't know about it, yeah. Like, they didn't know it was related to it.
I didn't realize that. Because I thought the city was, like, right below it, basically.
No, but he can't even see Devil's Reef until he goes to the beach, right? Like, he goes there with the old man, right?
Oh, yeah, he does, yeah.
And like, then dusk falls, and, yeah. Like, so, I feel like
they
shot
know.
Torpedoes in the town because it's a good way to blow up an
undersea town.
Yeah.
Right.
But, like, the reef is far enough out that it's actually...
Yeah, I mean, like, and even in modern, wrapping back around to the map thing, that's one of the cool things about the ocean, not to nerd out on the ocean, is that it's one of the few places that we still don't know everything about it. Like, if you go deep right. ocean, like, there's still deep ocean stuff that they call that the final frontier, is deep ocean, because we totally don't know anything about, like, most of that.
Yeah. Yeah, they're still discovering new species down
there. Yeah, yeah, and we don't have that mapped out. So that's the one GPS location you can still get lost in completely.
I interviewed for an article I was writing, an ichthyologist.
Oh,
you
nice,
guys know
nice.
What that is?
Yeah, fish doctor.
Yeah, fish doctor, which that word comes up in this story. And I was like, oh, I know what that means just because I interviewed the guy. And he had just discovered a new fish called the pancake batfish.
Yeah. Did he come up with the name? Because he could have done better.
I can't remember whether he came up with it.
I mean, not to Monday morning quarterbacking a fish name, but really.
Tell you what, Cody, why don't you go get your PhD in ichthyology?
You know what? I will.
Because... That is one of my favorite nerd out things, though, is marine biology.
Yeah, no, it's awesome.
And that's another reason I really like this story. Like, I do agree. I think that is, like, a place that holds up mystery-wise. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I like Dunwich Horror is because, like, there are still a lot of towns. Like, there are... In that story, where it's more just like buried in the Appalachian woods, right? Yeah. So, like northeast, it's not Appalachian, but it's like one of those towns in a hillside that like is buried in the forest.
Yeah,
and like other countries too, like Ireland still has like coastal towns where it's like you can't really get there. Like you can walk there, you can take carriages,
right? Or like you can get there, but like
right,
like the roads are dirt and like
yeah,
the people there are unassuming and they're fine knowing each other and like that exists.
Yeah,
but. Yeah, like I like a believable set, and like Mountains of Madness, I think is just so well done with the tension that like even though some of the cityscapes are hard to believe with today's point of view, like it's just cool that they tried so hard to like really make you just wonder what the fuck. The monster in Mountains of Madness is pretty lame, in my opinion.
It's a Shoggoth,
and it's, I think, the worst written Shoggoth. He spends too much time describing it, and it's written from the point of view of somebody running at full speed looking over their shoulder.
Right.
So, like, he goes into details, and you're like, I don't get how this guy is seeing this shit. Like,
yeah.
Though he is trampling 6-foot-tall penguins, which is pretty
cool.
The
other weird part, like, they don't do, like, a completely good job of describing if the penguins are blind or cave blind. And so, like, he, like... And he talks about how they're sort of dumb and like how the Shoggoth feeds on them.
Mm-hmm.
But like, they're 6 feet tall. Like, part of you, like, they can't just be herd penguins. And like, yeah, like, I was always like under the impression Antarctica has 6 month nights also. And like, wouldn't normal penguins then be blind? Like, if they only need their eyesight half the year, do they like really need to rely on like their vision? Like, I there's something about that that maybe
I thought I read somewhere that the either the Shoggoths after they gained intelligence or the deep ones like bred these penguins for food for the Shoggoths.
The old ones.
Yeah.
Oh, right. The old ones in the Mountains of Madness. Yeah, that's right. But I thought I read somewhere that they bred them, those penguins,
I think specifically. But like, I think he's speculating. And part of the weird thing in that one, too, is like, I like the tapestries, but they get a little confusing. Like, that also becomes like such amazing.
That was the first Lovecraft I ever read. And
I think that's kind of a lot of people's introduction for some reason.
Yeah.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Do you guys know the call or the cry of the Shoggoth?
No.
It's like a whistling noise, right? I don't remember what it is.
Well, Cody's gonna laugh when I say it. I don't know whether you'll laugh, Dan.
I'm tempted to say it's like the bird in Slaughterhouse 5.
I don't remember.
That's Pooty Wheat.
Okay, it's not that, but it does sound like a bird call. It's Tequila Lee.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yes.
Which I actually really liked.
Now, do you guys know where else that occurs? I think Cody probably does. What other book that we have mentioned tonight?
The Pink Swastika?
No.
No, Shadow Over Innsmouth? There's Shoggoths in it.
Yeah, no, but there's another book that we have mentioned tonight that also has Tequila Lee. Tequila Lee.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
What?
It's The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym.
Oh!
By Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, shit. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, when they meet some natives. Aren't they in Antarctica as well?
Yeah.
They meet some natives, and that is their cry. That is their...
Antarctica ain't got no natives.
Tequila Lee! But when you think
that
of
that... That was the point. It was this like Black Island that was near Antarctica.
Ugh.
and all these black natives on it. And then that was the point, was that it was like, who are these people? There are no people over here. Yeah.
Yeah, they were
savages. So it's like a shout out
savages,
to old school Poe racism.
Yeah. I mean, they were called savages even. You know?
Yeah. Oh, there was a lot of, he basically just describes everything as black.
Their teeth were black.
The water was black. Everything's black. And then they meet a white goddess that is pure beauty. Yep.
Give me a break.
No, Poe was very heavy-handed with his racism.
My problem, though, with the call of the Shoggoth is, so you picture the Shoggoth, it's like the size of a train car, and it's just like this blob, amorphous blob, with like eyes forming and unforming.
Right.
I have a hard time picturing that creature going, Tequila Lee! Yeah. Tequila Lee!
Well, but the blob is supposed to be like a... like a janitor, like a
yeah.
And
that's
part
right.
of it is that it can assume other forms,
right.
And like
they give you
the impression. I'm pretty sure I'm not messing this up, but I'm pretty sure that's another thing where they say that's the way the old ones spoke. You're hearing the call that like they once shared with their masters.
Okay. I think I read that.
And so it's actually like the language of the old ones that it's trying to like, it's like the only way of understanding how to communicate is to say that. It might be saying, I'm going to eat the shit out of you, you weird ass pink piece of shit. Like, but
going back to the dialogue, because I haven't read Lovecraft in a while until this, I had forgotten how little it seems that Lovecraft talks to people because of his dialogue. Because, like, Stephen King, in his book On Writing, uses a paragraph from Lovecraft to show how to not write dialogue.
Yes.
And I had forgotten.
And Stephen King loves Lovecraft, too.
Yeah, but his
Stephen
dialogue
King's On Writing
is
one of the best books ever written.
Of course, yeah. It is great. It's amazing. And even reading that, because I read that again recently, a couple months ago, even in that paragraph, it still had not hammered home his dialogue until I read this. And like we were talking about with Zadok, it's just like, oh my God, the dialogue.
Well, Zadok's monologues are just uninterrupted
for pages and pages.
Well, even the train depot guy is like 2 pages of him just describing Innsmouth. Like he goes on forever. There's a part where the train guy is saying, there's a bus, but nobody ever gets off at Innsmouth. Why do they not get off at Innsmouth? Well, it's because of these reasons. He even asks and answers his own questions during the monologue.
And it's the thing is, like, it's a monologue, not dialogue. And I think he does it intentionally to build tension.
Yeah.
He creates this idea that you're in this intimate scenario where one person just wants to talk more.
Mm-hmm.
And it is weird to make the narrator interrupt in the past tense, and he knew that, and his way around it was to just not have the narrator talk. What I just find funny is the way Lovecraft gets these characters, like you're saying, like to answer their own questions and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of I think if a contemporary writer were to try to write in this style, they would, I mean, I should just go read some Cthulhu Mythos and say this directly, but like they would have them interrupted by action more, and not. But
yeah,
like these, what is so funny about it is like even more than just like talk, like asking your answering your own questions. Like these people will be like, I reckon, you know, when it must have gone like this. You know what? I heard a story and it goes like this. Now that story. And the way they keep going on tangents, it's just like, like you picture them not even moving where they're standing. Like
they
give you the impression
like,
that they're just sort of like rubbing their chin from different angles.
It feels like an adventure game. Like it really feels like an adventure game, like Fable or Grand Theft Auto or Link, where you're just running around talking to people and they just stand there and they say things to you. And then you like click a button, you click A, and then they keep talking. And they're just kind of standing there gesturing the whole time.
It actually reminds me most then of a game a little older than that, Diablo.
Oh, yeah, Diablo.
Where like it's demons for one thing, but like... Yeah, you go up to these people and they tell you these long fucking monologues about why the demons have like invaded these caves or like why they're trapped in the caves, and like it fucking goes on, and they just stand and you've just killed demons, and yet you just stand there while this voice actor goes, well, I remember when I first, that's my Jimmy Stewart, you know, Don Knotts impression, but like
you are a Lovecraft protagonist in that situation. Standing there listening to somebody give you exposition.
And a lot of video games are like that. But in this case, it's funny because if you play one of those video games, it gets creepy to watch them stand there and keep talking at you. Do you ever play Oblivion or Elder Scrolls or like Fallout 3? Where they come up to you and like, this is the scariest fucking thing about Elder Scrolls games is these people will talk to you. Sometimes they interrupt you even, and you have to talk to them, and that it's, and you'll often, I'll be in third person mode. So you see your character like on screen running around.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as they run up to you, the camera goes shoom right up in this person's face as if it's first, but not even just first person, but zooms in. So even if you're in first person mode and you're running around with this, and all you see is this, like a bobbing hands holding a sword, you still drop your sword and the camera goes shoom right in their face as they start saying this thing to you with this terrible, Uncanny Valley, like CGI, like expressionless face. And I like those games, but yeah, like, and I feel like the downside of all those games is the writing is often terrible. Mm. Like the games will be amazingly built and look perfect, but the writing will be clearly written by like graphic designers who don't have any interest in sharing their money with writers.
Yeah,
like clearly, like computer engineers who are like, all right, guys, I have to go to the producer and propose this budget. Do we want 30,000 kinds of swords and I write it? Or do I tell the producer we'll have 2 kinds of swords and we'll hire some shitty writers to like...
The thing, going back to the train guy, the thing that I also found funny about that was that he sets it up as if the train guy isn't like, is trying to like leave him a clue... the whole introduction before we get into the launching about Innsmouth from the train guy is that he's trying to leave him like a subtle clue that he can take the bus if he wants to because he balked at the price of the train.
Mm-hmm.
But then that subtle clue ends up being like 2 pages of exposition about Innsmouth and the bus. And then it's like, okay, well, you've kind of undercut because he's supposed to be kind of busy or not really supposed to obviously be suggesting this to somebody, but he's really obviously suggesting it to somebody. And it's weird that he sets it up like that and then the dialogue changes it.
Yeah, it's also kind of weird that he keeps saying these terrible things about Innsmouth. He's like, yeah, you might not want to go there, but I'm going to explain everything about it to you. So I'm basically saying you should go there. You know, this is very funny.
Yeah, and I'm willing to suspend my disbelief for that a little bit. But then when they say stuff like Gilman as part of like what gets me like, right, like, ooh. One other thing I really like about this is how it's sort of still like a way for nerds to describe. Like, I've heard so many people I didn't even know they read Lovecraft. And then they'll be like, ugh. Like rednecks, like it's like Shadow over Innsmouth, kind of. You know, like it's become sort of shorthand. At least this has happened to me I can think of 3 different times. Mm-hmm. Only one time was this person a comedian, where they were like, ugh, do you ever read that book Shadow over Innsmouth? It's sort of what this Denny's feels like. It's become in a lot of ways it reminds me of like the one where like it's almost like white people are like the victim. The video game Fallout 3 has a really fun expansion pack where you go to this swamp and like the rednecks have devolved and like there's like a beachside mansion and everything. It's very Lovecraftian.
Oh, wow. That sounds cool.
Yeah, there's like, and in the main game outside the expansion pack before that even came out, there's a building called the Dunwick Building. Where you can like go through this like whole cult that developed after it's a post-apocalypse game, but it's like a radiated landscape, and then you find this old office building where like these post-apocalyptic like cultists like found this crazy irradiated like alien thing. Like it was turning them into ghouls, like these like fleshless like zombie people.
I have one other very short game I would love you guys to play if you can.
Let's do it.
Okay. This game is called Sexy Voice.
Oh, no.
Sexy Voice. Okay.
I think the scariest part of this episode was Runjit saying sexy voice.
That is pretty scary. Pretty scary. So here's what I want you guys to do. I'm going to tell you a phrase right now. And this is the phrase for the whole game. Okay. The phrase is, ooh, or you can say oh, or ah, any of those things. You've got the Innsmouth look. You've got the Innsmouth look.
So you want us to say that in our sexiest voice?
Yeah, but here's how it's going to work.
How is this a game?
Here's how it's going to work. Okay, there's more details, guys. Come on. Okay. So Dan's going to go first, and then Cody, and then Dan, and you don't have to like wait for each other to finish. It should be a sexy voice, like interrupting each other, and you don't have to stick to those words. That's just the starting point. Okay?
Wait, this is turning into a David Lynch movie really fast.
Right? All right?
This was a scene in Mulholland Drive. I'm pretty sure a guy in a cowboy hat's going to walk in the room really soon.
So you don't have to stick through that, but it's like you're really trying to seduce someone by telling them they have the Innsmouth look.
By the way, me trying to sound sexy will be the scariest thing you've ever heard in your life. That's a promise. You've got the Innsmouth look.
Okay.
You've got that Innsmouth look.
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 That Innsmouth, look, you've got it. You've got that Innsmouth look. You've got that Innsmouth look.
And scene.
Dan totally won that round.
Let's just say I am feeling very relieved after that segment.
Oh, God.
Very relieved.
Oh, my God. Does anybody else have anything else that they wanted to cover from the book, from the novella?
Well, let's see. Definitely never use Ancestry.com or it will turn out you're an inbred mutant. No matter how educated you are, you will still mumble in weird, like nonsensical vowel-less speech. And frog people will lock themselves in their house for some reason, like, and that they don't adapt their house full of bathtubs and hoses. They just hide in the corner and
they,
like,
let the place go.
Yeah, like, go. I feel like the real lesson I've learned is, like, hoarders are, like, the biggest threat. And we need to put cameras in all their homes and try and flush them out on national television.
Because otherwise, they might be frog people.
They are going to take over.
Yeah.
And the other lesson, if you see the word Dagon or Dagon, well, I don't know how you say
it. It's in the Elder Scrolls video game.
Okay.
This stuff has permeated, like, all video games.
If you ever see that word on a church, just stay away. Then don't move to that town.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also don't move to a town that's surrounded by marshes. That's probably it. That's probably just a good catch-all.
And if a lot of the businesses in town have names that are actually fish puns, stay away from there as well.
Do we want to do Amazon reviews before we split off into the night?
Sure.
The town of Innsmouth is grimy, fishy, and run down. We can just call it the Cleveland of Massachusetts.
Bada bing.
And that was by Kyle. Thank you, Kyle. Did Kyle also write this book, ... took my brain and put it in a blender and slowly poured it back into my head through my ears? Is that the same Kyle?
That is one and the same.
Because that sounds very Lovecraftian in itself. He probably has to write fan fiction.
Here's one of my favorites. One curious thing I have to point out is, as well as the narrator on this tale, I was also on a trip to a small town myself during this reading, and I finished it almost at the very last minute before taking the bus back home. Dun dun dun. Pretty spooky, right, guys?
It's like the novel was connected to her life.
I bought this book not knowing what it was about, right after shopping for jewelry. And then later, I found out that I come from some people who are gross. That review is by a person I just made up. I didn't actually read that one.
That's from Amazon user Dan. Dan.
Lovecraft did for New England what Fred and Rosemary West did for the Gloucester Tourist Board, and what the meat pie floater did for South Australian cuisine.
I had to look up Fred and Rosemary West.
Yeah, what
did you
the
guys?
Fuck is that even talking about?
They are a couple who were serial killers in Australia.
Well, cool. Let's just go ahead and wrap it up.
Dan, do you have any shows or anything coming up in November that you would like the people to know about?
Probably. I'll tweet about it.
Okay.
There.
What's your regular Twitter account?
Dan Telfer. One word.
At Dan Telfer.
D-A-N-T-E-L-F-E-R.
And Dan, what's the title of your awesome CD?
Tendrils of Ruin.
And can they find that on iTunes?
They sure can.
Can they find it on Amazon?
Yes, they can.
Well, there you go, then.
There you go. You
can, much like the old ones, you cannot escape it. There you go.
And much like the half-human, like, offspring, they can't escape it either. They are going to turn into deep ones, and they're going to end up in the lake forever.
Okay, here's something that really bugs me about. How is it if you descend from the fish people, it like develops like in your like 40s. Like, that's weird.
Maybe it's like a psychological thing. You know, like repressed memory, but it's like repressed genome. Like, he, you know, because I mean, because there is
that's certainly the way I've been thinking it.
There's that strong connection always in Lovecraft between the mind and the body. And so maybe there's this thing where because his mind is awakened to it.
Yeah, I think you're supposed to, I think, get a sense of like, on some level, these people recognize him.
Yeah.
And like, mm-hmm. they're trying to like coerce him a little bit.
Well, and there's also a sense in this book that he, even before he knows what's going on with him, he's drawn to that place.
Yeah. You know?
Like, by forces beyond his understanding.
Mm.
Although that is another sort of staple of Lovecraft. Like characters like, I know I shouldn't go to this place, but
yes.
I felt compelled by the rich mysteries of the shadow, and like, a shadow I knew when I shined a light upon it would delight the world and academics across, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you get eaten by a tentacle.
So the whole Cthulhu mythos can be boiled down to curiosity killed the cat named N-word man.
Or just curiosity killed the N-word man.
Curiosity killed the N-word man. There we go.
Oh, man. Well, this has been Tome Foolery. We hope you all enjoyed it as much as we did. My name is Cody Melcher.
I'm Runjit Sowry, and thank you to our guest tonight, Dan Telfer. That was Dan's trying to speak in Cthulhu speak.
I think it was an accurate representation.
That was him trying to say Tequila Lee.
Yes, yes.
Tequila Lee.
All right. Good luck descending into madness. Lord knows we've already been there. Have a good night.
Have a good night.
To show how much I love you, darling, I would shoot the mayor. They'd lock me in a psycho ward, but I wouldn't care. I'd stroll into the courtroom in my straitjacket and tie. And when they put me on the stand, here's what I'd testify. I'd say, I'm crazy, crazy, crazy. I'm crazy, crazy, crazy. I'm crazy, crazy, crazy about you.